This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
sorry, hold on a minute. I'm going to need to recover here.
And Brock Rahm.
What? I'm going to get into it here.
We're taking your questions in episode 15. We tackle our most memorable moments in sports, the skill sets in high demand right now, and we get into a hotly debated question about style relating to the storytelling process.
All right.
That was like a clapper.
That's a clap, baby. Did it sound like a clapper to you? You guys were way late to me.
That sounded pretty tight.
You guys are right on with me.
All right.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
When we bought this house, it was new, so it was like a spec house, but like the walls were already done when we put our offer in. So like I couldn't have him run any Ethernet or anything, and I couldn't come in and do like my own low voltage work or anything. And so in this room, which they dub a media room, there's no coax cable drops and there's no Ethernet anywhere. So like I have no way of like getting hardwire in here, and my I don't have Wi-Fi on my desktop PC or anything. So yesterday I had to drill through the wall right there. That's an outside wall.
Next to the Emmys.
All the way through the wall next to the Emmys right there. You can see the Emmys right there.
Have you worn a Emmy before?
I don't know. Brittany got me this very nice display case for them and put it together. Nice. It's very nice. It was very nice of her. But I had to drill through this wall right here that goes outside, then run coax and Ethernet down the side of my house and around to like the spectrum box. It was not fun, but it works now.
Well, I thought I'd start off the exact same way I started off episode one for this Q&A podcast, which is by saying, hey guys, thanks for joining. This is awesome. I appreciate it. Only because I feel like how we've gone along here, the value that both of you have added, I've learned so much along the way, and I'm super appreciative that you guys have taken the time to really add a ton of value as we are trying to give back to this sports creative Slack community. So I wanted to start by trying to highlight what we were trying to set out to do when we started, which is provide actionable insight from industry professionals, not execs, while inspiring improved workflow habits and a greater diversity of content creation from ideation through execution. Basically focused on curiosity, commitment to learning and development, and action. And I think from my perspective, we had set out to focus on a younger demographic, the younger professionals. But I've learned so much just from all these conversations that we've had from both of you. And I had learned a ton from both of you in the last, 12 years since we all worked together at Husker Vision. So I guess one thing that I wanted to toss out to both of you is what has been the one thing that you guys have enjoyed the most about getting into this podcast?
I found out that my crutch word from editing the last couple episodes is you hit the nail right on the head there. But Justin, I think you hit the nail right on the head there with I love learning from people all the time. One thing I truly believe is I don't think anybody in the history of mankind has ever had an original thought. Everybody's thoughts are derivatives of other thoughts they've encountered or learned along the way. So people always say like, oh, how did you learn this? Or how do you know this? Well, 9 times out of 10, I learned it from somebody else, or I got the idea from somebody else and implemented it in a different way or in my own way. So I think one of the reasons I love doing this podcast is the same reasons when I was at Notre Dame, I loved working with students, is I always loved teaching people new things. And I loved sharing the information that I've acquired over the years, because I didn't always have that. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. In my career, sometimes I wish I had more. So I want to, you know, make sure I'm available to help with that. But also I love learning from you two, because even though we work in the same industry, we all do three very distinctly different things. and we work on different projects every single day. And I find that extremely interesting and enlightening and informative.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm right down that same vein where, you know, working in a network now, I don't have as much of an opportunity to work with students and younger professionals. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to kind of share some of my knowledge. Like, I don't know everything. I don't know most things, but, you know, it's just been fun to be able to talk about the industry the way I see it. And hopefully it resonates with someone, because I just care deeply about this industry. Like, I had a bunch of incredible, incredible people, you know, lift me up as I was coming up in the industry. And, you know, I just want to make sure that I'm doing the same and giving back in any way I can. And, you know, I also agree just again with what Brock said, that I've really loved the viewpoints that we all have and how they're different. You know, Brock has such a technical expertise, and Justin has a pretty, you know, well-rounded, you know, experience. I mean, we all do, but, you know, but with kind of a specialty now in graphics and people, team management and things like that. And I'm more on the feature side and the network side and the true producer side. It's so cool to see the way that we've all, you know, just gone different paths, but how much overlap there is among those three too. You know, different roles that we have and how we can kind of share different ideas, but all still come back to the same central principles of production.
It's funny you guys both touched on that, because I think it's important to highlight how even if somebody is an expert and does things day to day based on a conversation that we're having in the podcast episode, that hopefully they can learn something. But the variety is another big thing that I've heard as feedback, that people are enjoying the variety of the different conversations that we're having. And I think that's really where I've been excited to have both of you from such different perspectives, because obviously I wouldn't have been able to have such an in-depth conversation about audio that you guys brought to the table. So, or equipment. That Brock brought. And it's funny, after the equipment episode, I totally redid my whole setup here, and trying to get my DSLR set up as a webcam and getting the correct cables plugged in and all of that. So it's been a challenge to take what we've learned here and try and level up as well.
You do know the next step is doing this podcast live.
Hard pass.
Everybody needs to see Garrett's closet.
Listen. It's a great. He's in closet, his button up don't today. Get me wrong.
He's in a full suit, three piece.
Yeah, I got so tired of getting heckled for my fashion that I pulled out my wedding suit and just got real weird with it here in the closet.
So, speaking of memories, the most memorable one of the questions that we got was, "What is the most memorable moment you have all been a part of and your role in it, whether it was a project or the outcome of a game for a team that you were a part of?" Garrett, why don't we start with you?
sorry, hold on a minute. I'm going to need to recover here. Your camera just went out, Justin.
Maybe we can't do this live.
Me and Brock just noticed it at the exact same time, right after you're talking about the technical part and redoing your setup. So
I'm still working on it. Work in progress. That's what we're here for.
That's what you call irony.
All good. What was the question?
Most memorable moment with a team or organization in your career?
Okay, yeah. I would say for me, the most memorable moment, it probably would be Minnesota football, when there were probably two, and they were both in the same season. It was when we won the jug at Michigan, the Little Brown Jug rivalry game, trophy game. We had not beat Michigan in well over a decade. I want to say it was like 12, 13 years at that point since we had last won the jug, and we had won it like once in the last 25 years, even before that. So it's a very rare thing for Minnesota to beat Michigan. And to go onto their field and win that, I just remember like sprinting across the field with the team to go to the jug. And, you know, I remember I had a kind of another producer with me there, and I was, you know, just trying to like line up at halftime, like all the possibilities of, you know, how we were going to set up the post game and how we were going to go. And okay, you be by the trophy, you know, 2 minutes before the end of the game, unless it's a close game. If we're driving, if they're driving, then you got to stay close and sprint over there. I'm going to come from the side. Like, just, I remember like it was yesterday, and it was such a fun experience. Like, it was kind of when Minnesota football started to work their way back up. And that was a really cool win. But I think one of the more interesting story shoots that I ever had was that same year, and it was a football game too, but this was the year when Jerry Kill was coaching Minnesota and had some of his epileptic seizures and wasn't able to coach. And we went to Northwestern on the road, and Northwestern was a pretty good team that year. Minnesota, we knew we needed that game to kind of set ourselves on a path toward a good bowl game. I want to say we already had like seven wins, and it was, you know, late October. And so we really needed to kind of keep the momentum by beating Northwestern at Northwestern. And Coach Kill wasn't coaching, and he was supposed to just be at home, and he surprised the team. He was up in the press box, not coaching during the game, but he was just up there watching. He made the trip to Chicago unexpectedly, like the morning of the game. And he was down in, we won the game, and he was down in the locker room after the game waiting to surprise the team. And just the reaction from the team, the emotion from Coach Kill, like I think it's the only time I ever saw him cry. Like he's crying as he's talking to the team in his post-game speech. And those are the type of things that I remember probably even more than the games, is like those moments, you know. Even the Michigan game, I don't really remember. I remember a great Max Williams catch along the sideline, but like, I don't really remember much of the game. I remember the moments around the game, you know, that kind of make those things stand out to me. But that one where Jerry Kill surprised the team in the locker room, just seeing the emotion of the team, the emotion of Kill, like the emotion, that's what you remember. And those were two really, really good moments.
I think for me, again, I have a couple. The first one that sticks out is when I was with the Kansas City Chiefs, you know, I was directing the big screen show there, and Eric Berry was coming back after battling Hodgkin's lymphoma for the first time, and doing his individual run out and directing that was such a cool moment to see what he had overcome. And then that moment just coupled with the fans at Arrowhead. And I thought the way my team covered it, was perfect. I was really proud of everybody, and how we blocked that out and how it all worked out. Also that first, Notre Dame video board game, first football video board in Notre Dame history. I had a team that worked till 2-3 a.m. every night for a month straight, you know, to get that done, and to see all that hard work pay off in a way that was exactly how we wanted it to. That was really special. And then my network directing debut for NBC, NBC Sports, with hockey and then college football was special. That's something I always wanted to do. Was growing up, you know, when I first realized that maybe TV was something I wanted to do, I wanted to direct sports on national TV. And I was very fortunate to get that opportunity. It wasn't because I was good. It was because they wanted to save money. And they're like, you know what, Brock can just direct this. Nobody cares. But still, I was very fortunate to be able to do it. And it was a very cool learning experience. But a lot of mine come from, you know, I love working in a team environment. I love, you know, nothing gets done in a vacuum. So anytime I'm part of a large team and we're working towards a bigger goal, those are the moments that are really, really the most memorable. Things like production days, big shows we've been working for weeks and months on, things like that.
I just want to jump in real quick on that. You know, the team days, the production days, the camaraderie between team and stuff like that. There is one other moment kind of related to that stands out to me. And it was, again, when I was at Minnesota. It was our first year. We had just started, like, the big screen program at Minnesota. They had like two student workers the year I got there. And the next year we grew it to like 30. And I remember the first like month, it just felt like there was no chemistry between the students, and coming from a big screen like athletic department program, I knew how important that was. Like, we hung out together all the time. It made us better. It made us like want to be in the office. And I remember a month in to having that like group of 30 students, I heard them planning like a Gopher Digital Productions only party at their house. And it was like, yes, yes. Like, this is what we need. This is how this program is going to grow, was to finally feel the camaraderie between the students and like know that they wanted to hang out. And like, you know, I had to plug my ears so I wasn't hearing about some of the, you know, some of the party planning, because I just didn't want to know about it. But it was just such a cool thing to hear that come together. That's when I knew we'd be okay, you know, in starting up that department, when I heard the students wanted to have a party with only people from that department.
So I think Brock will appreciate my first comment here, because when I was an intern, my first internship right out of school when I graduated from Nebraska was at the United States Olympic Committee out in Colorado Springs. I had seen Nebraska's tape archives, and it was a huge room. I had never seen tapes so old as when I was at the Olympic Committee. And that was part of my job, is to burn time code into tapes and create a DVD.
Oh boy.
This was like 13 years ago. It was all analog, and send it out so that people could pay for footage from the Olympics. And they went all the way back to 1934. So our broadcast director out there had a 24 deck setup. And in order to access some of the decks, because of the footage and the tapes of being so old, you had to route it through. So sometimes it was, okay, well, in order to get this one, you have to route tape deck 8 through 10 and then bring it through 24 in order to see the footage pull up here on this screen. So that was pretty cool. And just to be in that environment to see the historic accomplishments of all the Olympics and Winter Olympics, because there's no such thing as a Summer Olympics. That's something that still drives me nuts. But it was just cool just to live in the barracks and see the athletes as they came through and just be in that atmosphere. But I've brought up going to the White House with the Bears already, and that's super high on my list and really cool. I shot the coldest game I've ever shot was Mike Ditka's retirement ceremony on December 9th, Monday Night Football game. It didn't start till 8:30. At 8:30, the temperature was -4 below wind chill. It was like 12 degrees and then -4 degree wind chill. That's the only game that I've ever shot where I couldn't feel my hands by the end of the first quarter. And usually you use halftime to go inside and get your hand warmers and, you know, warm up a little bit. Not that game. That retirement ceremony took up the whole halftime, and I was out there the whole time. So that was about a month before I came to Boston and decided that indoor suited me a little bit better. But I think the thing that is top of my list is going to London with the Bears when we went over and played in Wembley, just because of that. That experience is a once in a lifetime experience. It was so cool to see all the players in a unique element, getting out. They played cricket, you know, seeing Brian Urlacher hold a cricket bat and Jay Cutler pitch to him, and you know, see him both be able to hit the ball, and just be in that atmosphere where I pulled up to a Molt box and I go, okay, well, I'm in Europe. Do I record in PAL or do I record in NTSC?
Everybody knows it's illegal in Europe to record anything besides PAL.
Yeah. So it was just a totally unique experience. The team allowed significant others and family members to go over there. So it was really like a family atmosphere, just to be able to see the palace and seeing Trafalgar Square and all the fans that were over there and the support of sports. And it was just a really memorable experience for me.
Yeah. I think international travel is just an unbelievable experience. And I just got to do it last summer for a production with Big Ten Network in Italy. We followed Nebraska basketball around Italy, and just having those kind of experiences, it's so weird. Like I was working so much and we were so in the moment on production that it didn't even feel all that much like I was in Italy, which kind of makes me forget about it. But yeah, you bringing up London, that was a hell of an experience too. So I really, it's pretty cool. I mean, I've said before that one of the things I really love about, you know, doing this job is the experiences that you get. And that was definitely one of them. So, you know, one of the topics that comes up, I think, in our podcast a lot is this idea of, you know, being a jack of all trades versus focusing your experience and your expertise in one, you know, subject. You know, kind of like we talked about earlier, we all kind of have our different things that we specialize in between us three. But, you know, one of the questions I get is at what point does it make sense to start to specialize? You know, how much mm-hmm. do you need to know about everything? And at what point then do you kind of pivot toward that specialization within the trade?
I'll start by saying I don't believe in the phrase jack of all trade, master of none. I think knowing a lot is only going to benefit you. And I think that's a cop out for people who don't want to learn new things. You should learn new things all the time, especially in your industry, whether it relates to your field or not. If it's about your industry, you should learn it. What I really realized, and I'm not calling out anybody specific here, but when I work with producers and directors on the live side, and they came through our room at Notre Dame, they were some of the least technical people I've ever met in my life. They had absolutely no idea how TV worked, right? Now, a part of me is like, well, they don't have to do their job. But I think it makes you better at your job. The producers who were the best producers who came through our room were the ones who had an understanding of how things worked. And then they could use that to their advantage to do different things, to ask the right questions, to get cameras in certain locations or do certain things on the switcher. They knew the right questions to ask. So even if you're specializing, I think it behooves you not just to know the technical side, but like I'm very technical now and I'm very, very happy that I worked a lot on the storytelling side for a very long time because it helps me set things up technically to help people tell stories better. But I've had a couple times in my career where I started in my career, and I think everybody kind of starts this way or maybe should start this way of doing everything. I shot, directed, edited, live, feature, you name it. I did it. Mainly because A, I was interested in it. I liked doing it. And B, because I felt like I had to get a job, to have a diverse skill set. So that way I could be, so I could apply and be more qualified for more jobs. And when I was at Kansas City, I did it all. I was a feature producer, shooter, editor, live director, engineer, you name it. I did it all. And then my next step at Notre Dame, I knew to take the step up, I was going to have to be more specialized. And that's when I felt that, okay, the live side is really where I'm most passionate about. It's probably where I'm best at. So I made that step. And then I had to make a very difficult decision, probably my hardest career decision, to specialize even further into the technical side when I moved on to Beck. And it was tough because I knew I could go one of two ways, and I had a couple opportunities on each side. I could either went and done live TV directing for a network and been a director, or I could have went this way and built broadcast facilities and control rooms and not directed. And that was really, really hard because live directing is one of my favorite things to do in the world. I love it. I love directing live TV, but I had to have an honest conversation with myself about what am I better at? Right. Where does my skill set align with more?
Or what do you enjoy more yourself?
Yeah,
right.
What do I enjoy more? And that was tough because honestly, it's tough. I love the work I do. I absolutely love it 100%, but I love directing too. It was hard. It's like trying to pick your favorite child, right? Nobody has a favorite child.
Unless there's one.
That's my favorite child. But yeah, it you know, but I knew I had to. There's not a world where I just get to go and be an engineer and a live director. Like I don't get to go to NBC and be a tech manager and the live director or an EIC and the live director. Like that doesn't happen. So part of it is, where's the career growth at? You know, where am I going to be happy at? And what am I better at? Where am I going to have a bigger impact at? But what I've found, and this is not true for everybody, every step up in my career I've had to make, I've had to become a little more specialized, a little more specialized, a little more specialized. So now, as you guys know, I've mentioned on this podcast, I'm a huge cinematography nerd. I love cameras and lenses. I still stay up to date with that. My webcam right now, I have my Blackmagic 6K going through my capture card. Like, you know, I still stay up with that. I love it. I still hobby shoot and do all that stuff, but it's not part of my job anymore. And now live directing is not part of my job. The only downside of that is I can't really have that as a hobby. I'm sure I could freelance if I had time, you know, down here in Austin for Longhorn Network or something. When things come back full and the Big 12 starts playing, but that's going to be so few and far between. It's not really realistic. But I don't regret it because I love where I'm at. I love the work I do. Even though I've had to give certain things up in my career as I move on, it's always been towards a bigger goal or a more professionally satisfying jump, if that makes sense.
We just need to source some multi-cam full game records for you. You can throw them in Premiere and live cut them in Premiere using the switcher. We can make it a hobby for you. Don't say anything's impossible, Brock.
Yeah, especially with NDI, you know, that we learned about with Jeff Volk. Can make anything happen.
You can do a lot in the cloud. No, I've seen a lot of people direct from home, do a lot of different stuff. It's wild what's going on out there in the world. But no, it's... And at some point in time, I have some multi-viewer records with some director and producer audio from my Diamond Directing TV that maybe we'll release some clips of someday down the road, because there's some real gold gems in there of me not being a good director. And you'll probably say, oh, well, Brock, you made the absolute right decision. You should not be directing live TV.
Well, it's a decision that you made, so I think it was the right decision.
Yeah. There are no wrong decisions. I'm very adamant about that, too. There's no bad choices. There's no wrong decisions. They're just different.
Yeah. What about you, Justin? When did you kind of realize like you wanted to or needed to specialize, and kind of how did you hone in on what you wanted to get into?
I want to touch on what Brock said. I think it's important to highlight that when you're starting, you do start with more of an ocean approach, that you do want to trial and error, right? You hit on different things. When I went to school, I wanted to be a play-by-play broadcaster for radio, and I spent some time in the College of Journalism being a radio DJ, doing play-by-play for soccer, getting the opportunity to do a football game, which was awesome. And when I got out and saw, started applying for jobs, I still applied for radio jobs and I ended up in production. And one of the things that we do for our entry-level positions is giving them all sorts of different opportunities. Because of my experience, I felt like providing that opportunity for people to go experience something, or maybe they go on a community shoot one day and have some variety so that they get a sense of, well, okay, I've done this a lot. I'm starting to really enjoy the shooting process a lot more than the editing process, or vice versa. And it, in my opinion, it really comes down to having a T skill set, basically, where if you look at the T that's upright, you want to have a really strong foundation in one part of your skill set so that you become indispensable in a job in that regard. And then if it's the capital T, if it's the crossbar over the top, then that's all your interests. And like Brock mentioned, I still shoot photos of my kids. No one else sees them, but that's how I stay involved in shooting and understanding what's going on with some of the equipment and stay up to date. And it's really a hobby of mine that I'm allowed to continue that also benefits me professionally. And that's, I think that's important to highlight. But as far as specialization, as I've gone along and my interests have developed, or I've leaned one way and then, you know, I've really leaned into motion graphics, and that has kind of pushed me into post-production. And as I've managed more, then it's more important for me to be in the office. So that really pushed me more into post-production and motion graphics. Doesn't mean I don't step out and shoot when it's absolutely necessary, but I think that's something that I've enjoyed along the way, that I've followed what interests me from what I'm doing. And I agree with Brock, the longer you're in the game, the accumulation of knowledge is so important. And that's why it's important to build a skill set intentionally and slowly, and not feel like you have FOMO, like, because then you just start running around chasing the shiny ball. So, you know, just intentionally focusing on what is important to you and what gives you joy, I think is something that I've found has really helped me.
Well, and it's a value add, right? So what I've found is me being able to shoot and edit is I can do promo videos for our company, right? That's a value add for me as an employee. That's not what they're hiring me to do, but we still do those types of things, and they would hire like a marketing agency to do it. But now we can do that stuff in-house and I'm not any extra money and I enjoy doing it. So I can just do little promos and sizzles. And you'll find that out through your career is, oh, I was hired to do this, but 5% of my time can be spent doing this. And that's a value add for your employer.
So I guess the other question is, if you were to give advice to somebody looking for a job right now, is there a technical skill that you would recommend based on how you've seen things go during COVID that you would recommend people should try and learn?
Listen, over half the jobs I see posted right now are engineering jobs. The Raiders need an engineer. The Phoenix Suns need an engineer. There's a lot of engineer jobs out there. And I know you might be thinking, oh, it's over my head or it's not really what I want to do. But if you're a technical person and you understand the broadcast side, there are certifications you can get. Like you could be Cisco certified. That really helps you in the IP world. You can get Dante level 3 certification. None of those are going to hurt to have. I think the Dante one is free. Cisco costs something. I'm not totally sure. But those are things that, again, that's very on the technical side, but over half the jobs I'm seeing right now are technically minded jobs, because it's a little recession proof, right? There's still systems that need to run and still need to operate, to work. So those people have still got to be there and making things work. So I know there's a lot of shooters, a lot of editors in our group, a lot of producers, but if you're a technical person, you're struggling to find work, you know, it may not be a bad time to start thinking about pivoting.
And can I add to that too? Just because you don't feel like you're an engineer and you feel like you're a more shooter editor, having that knowledge and being able to work collaboratively with IT, mm-hmm. that's huge. I'm going through a process right now of trying to work with our IT department to implement some structural adjustments and improvements and enhancements, and to be able to talk to them and trying to highlight why it's beneficial from that side. You get into asset management and you need, you know, disk, and you need to be able to have a system that talks through IT to be able to access, especially if you're remote. So even if you're on the shooter editor side and don't necessarily want to go on the engineering side, that's still really important information to understand to work with IT.
Yeah, you always want IT on your side. If there's one thing I've learned from every job I've ever been in, it's make friends with the IT people on day one.
The other thing I'll say is don't be intimidated by it. A lot of people feel like, oh, for me to be a broadcast engineer, I have to have an electrical engineering degree or a computer engineering degree. You don't. At Beck, probably half of our engineers have an electrical engineering degree. The other half don't. The other half are like me. I broadcast journalism. You know, I'm not an engineer from college, but I have enough relevant experience that they're okay with that, right? That happens in a lot of different industries. The other thing I'll say is if you're a developer, and I don't know how many in our group are, I know there are some, and you can develop using FFmpeg libraries and FPGAs. I'm not going to get too deep here, I promise. But every piece of broadcast hardware in the world runs on FPGAs and or FFmpeg libraries. And if you could do that, you can just write your own check for a manufacturer. So if you're a developer and you're looking for new skills to learn, or you're looking to hone something new, definitely look into FPGA programming and working with FFmpeg libraries, even just something like Python, because there's plenty of manufacturers out there who are looking for that skill set. You can probably work remote and do pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, I think the technical stuff is all really important, and it's probably what I would say you really need to have a big grasp on. as you get into the industry and, you know, are trying to find a job or, you know, prepare yourself for your next job. I mean, it just, even in this kind of work from home workflow, you know, how important it is to know codecs and remote delivery and all those kind of things. But I also think that, you know, and this is my bias showing here, storytelling is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, not just in knowing how to do it, but train yourself to identify a good story. Like, look at a commercial and think of it as, you know, what story are they telling, rather than like, oh, what brand is this for? Oh, this Tide commercial. Like, just think of it as, what story are they telling and how are they telling it? When you start to do that with, you know, every little, you know, piece of branding that's out there, all of a sudden it starts to become not second nature, but it just clicks a little bit more in your mind. And I think that that's really important, because at the end of the day, everything we do, especially when you work for a brand or a team or whatever, it's just marketing. You're trying to tell the story of the brand.
Garrett and Justin, question for you guys. Have you guys ever dove into the masterclass stuff where they have like David Lynch teaches one, Ken Burns teaches one, Ron Howard teaches one about directing and filmmaking and storytelling?
I haven't, no.
I've always been very curious. They're very expensive. It's not cheap.
It didn't seem worth it to me, but that's right. Just from my perspective.
But I'm just curious if any of our listeners have ever watched or paid for the masterclass stuff. I think it's $15 a month or something like that. And if they thought it was worth it, because there's some big names on there. I love, you know, David Lynch and Ken Burns.
The issue for me was that it was talking at you. And they have unbelievable experience. I fully get that those are the biggest names to be. If you want to get to where they wanted to go, I mean, it's an opportunity for you to sit in and listen and take some wisdom from them. The practical side of that is where I saw the challenges. And that's just me personally, because I like to be hands-on and follow along to learn.
One of my favorite YouTube channels, I don't think they do anything more, and I've said it on this podcast before, but Every Frame of Painting is probably my favorite, like, cinematography, like, storytelling YouTube channel, where they break down shots just through history and how every single thing in that shot is specific and designed for the story and how it moves the story further. Again, being a cinematography nerd, I think storytelling through imagery without any words being said is so important. And I think that's a really good YouTube series you can binge through and just realize, not that everything you do needs to be as intentional as a big budget movie, right? But you can do little things, you know, in your day-to-day work, that help drive your story better visually through your images. And the other thing I'll always say is, Justin, that School of Motion class you took, I haven't taken it, but I've heard multiple people take it. Again, it's not cheap, but the results are there. I saw you go from a good motion graphic artist to like an unbelievable one, right? And it probably a lot of it started with that class. So
it really did for me, but the thing that they highlight that I think is really interesting is they say this class is going to be hard. And when you go around the internet, you see people promoting how easy something is, right? Oh, it's this easy tip will help you. This easy tip will help you. This easy. It's no, doing real hard work is where you're going to get the benefits. And it's super hard. I know a lot of people that went through that class that didn't even make it to the end. And I think that's what I get at when I say you have to do something that you enjoy, because in order for you to advance and really want to put in the time and the effort that it's going to take for you to get good at that, you have to be willing to sacrifice in some regard in order to make it happen. And to touch on that too, I think we can move on to a slightly different conversation, but I don't even know if you guys know this. I didn't get my first full-time job with benefits until I was 26. And everything up to that point, I was taking, I had a full-time job. I just didn't have benefits for 2 years when I was in Illinois. But then when I left there and followed my wife up to Chicago, I took a seasonal job to get my foot in the door. So I sacrificed for 4 years to try and make it in sports. And I mean, I know you guys have both sacrificed trying to take jobs to make it. And I think in general, since I got out in January of 08 was when I was looking into the market. I know that's a similar market to what it is today with COVID, is you have to do what it takes to make yourself relevant, to take the job, even if you feel like it's another seasonal or it's a graduate assistantship, or you feel like you should have a full-time job. You have to do what it takes for fighting for your career, for what you want.
Well, guys, we had a good discussion there about storytelling. I think that kind of segues us into the next question we have, which is the storytelling process and initially staying on brand when you're telling a story. Justin and Garrett, I'll set you guys up for this because you do a lot more of it than me, is how do you make sure you're staying on brand? What unwritten rules are there when you're telling a story?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's just knowing what your brand is. I think that's where it has to start, because, I mean, on Journey, we're, you know, no narration on our stories. We're, you know, looking off to the side of the camera. We're not looking down the barrel. You know, we tend to have a little moodier look for our interviews, where it's kind of, you know, darker rooms with just lit subjects and things like that. But that's not always true. You know, like we're able to flex, you know, if we have a great outside look and it's, you know, a guy or a girl or whoever we're interviewing sitting outside and, you know, leaning up against a fence or whatever, like we can go that route too. So I think it's first, like, know what your brand is so that you know how to stay on brand, and also know when you can break it. And you have to know what your brand is, and you have to have like a really good idea of, you know, when it makes sense to like not go that route to be able to. I mean, it's like you got to know the rules to break them. It's like broadcast 101. It's 90% of the industries in the world. Like, rules are bendable, rules are breakable, but you got to know what they are to be able to get there. So I think it's just, I don't think, you got to know what rules are breakable, which ones aren't, when you can go off brand a little bit in to further a story. And you also have to know when going off brand is going to take away. Like, I will never, no matter what type of interview I'm doing for the Journey, I will never have someone look down the barrel, because I just know it's not our style. And like, the Journey has been on air for, I think, 11 years now. So, you know, it is not a year in and it's like, oh, well, maybe people haven't noticed that, you know, we don't do any down the barrel. Like, 11 years in, it's just not happening. So I think
when you say down the barrel, you're talking like looking directly into the camera.
Looking right into the camera lens. Yeah, that's what I mean when I'm saying down the barrel. Yeah. So it's, you know, and we're not going to go the E60 style either, where we're giving them short looking room, you know, on one side of the camera. But it, you know, hey, that's just a style. Like, it's not my style. I don't really, it's not my favorite, but I, you know, they've got their brand, they've got their style, and some people really love it.
Like, it's done right, which I haven't seen much of. If it's done right, where there's leading lines and you look like the only place for you to look is right at their eyes, good. There's a lot of faux E60.
I'm gonna get into it here, and I apologize if anybody works on E60 on the channel. I hate. So Garrett, I'll set this up a little bit. You said it absolutely perfectly. You have to know the rules to break them, but I'll go one step further. You have to have narrative intent to break the rules. And Jody Massad was a big influence on this on me. The rules are there to be broken if you have a narrative intent to break them. And that brings me to the E60 in the small looking room. Have you guys seen the Jinx series on HBO?
No, I haven't.
No.
So the Jinx is about a Robert Durst, who was a suspected killer, right? And a lot of the topics they talked about were very uncomfortable, and they used small looking room, you know, looking to the short side of the frame to make you feel uncomfortable when they were talking about uncomfortable subjects. That is a prime example of breaking the rule for narrative intent. They wanted you to feel uncomfortable while looking at this shot because they were talking about an extremely uncomfortable subject. That's like my favorite example of how and when to break the rules. Winning 60 does it, and I could be wrong. I'm open to have somebody come on and tell me differently. I don't get that there's a narrative reason to do it. I think they do it because they think it's a cool stylistic brand for them. And it's not a true narrative choice where I'm sitting there looking at somebody talking to me off the frame on the short side, and it's making me feel uncomfortable, but they're not talking about an uncomfortable subject. Right. So that, again, that's my problem with it. And not saying it doesn't work all the time. It does work sometimes. They do talk about uncomfortable things on E60 a lot. Right. But not all the time. And you'll see that if you go watch the Jinx, they really only do the small looking room when they're talking about uncomfortable subjects. It's very, very intentional. And that goes back to every frame is a painting. How are you using your visuals and your framing to drive your narrative? And is the decision you're making actually helping or hindering? And on the E60, I think it hinders.
Oh, there's nothing I love like fired up Brock. It's just, man, when you get on a roll, it is fun to watch.
But it's subjective, right? Like I'm not right or wrong. It's subjective. It's art. Like that's the beauty of it. You don't have to listen to me.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I disagree with that. Actually,
it's fair.
I'm not personally, a big fan of that small looking room style, but like it is a style. It is their style. I mean, to some extent, like they've normalized it. You know, you see it more in just general productions than you ever would have even 5-10 years ago. And it's starting to become normal. Like that's how things happen like that, is that, you know, why do we look off to the side of the camera in general in interviews? Like that is weird. Like what is the reason that ever started? What is the reason it ever started to look right down the lens of the camera? Like at some point, new styles have to start somewhere. So like, I get where you're coming from. Like, I understand the idea of like not liking the little looking room and it kind of making you anxious, but like, I mean, they just took a style, they ran with it, they made it their own, and eventually it will, you know, I don't want to say it will, but if it becomes more widespread, like it just becomes a normal style choice. It doesn't become this like anxious, weird feeling when you see it anymore. And I don't know that I would make that decision myself, but I think it's where creativity comes from. It's where the new styles and the new ways of doing things come from, is someone taking a chance and just getting weird with it.
I'm all for pushing the boundaries. I think, you know, people thought that Peter Jackson thought that 48 frames per second was going to be the new film standard. Some people thought it was going to be 60. It doesn't look right. And people, we're not going to see films in 60p.
I love it in sports
anytime soon, you know, because it makes people feel a certain way. I'm not disagreeing. I'm not saying I can't get there. But to me, it's in line with that. It's in line with, like, I personally, and again, Garrett, like you said, this only comes through repetition and normalizing things. But when I see it, it makes me anxious and it makes me feel wrong. Right. Yeah. Which I think can be a really good narrative, a really good storytelling framing and aspect, right?
But sure,
to me, you know, I just, it'd be very hard. It's honestly, and this is probably unfair, it makes me not want to watch E60 when I see it, because it just makes me irrationally angry. And I understand it's irrational, but like,
where I agree with you is that I think it probably came from the first story that they did it on was, there was an intention behind it. And then either through someone else seeing it going, okay, we're going to copy the what here and not the why. Then when they went to execute it, then it just kind of carried on. Or after ESPN saw it and E60 was like, okay, that's our look. Or maybe it was premeditated all the way along. Who knows?
I would love somebody, if somebody on who listens or is on the channel or knows somebody who works on E60, I would love to hear the story behind it, you know, and hear the rationale, because I'm sure there's more rationale than me just saying like, oh, they thought it looked cool. So yeah, they just did it. Like, I get that. That's me. That's me.
I'm just going to tell you guys, I'm being on the storyteller side. I feel like you're being a little harsh. Like I'm taking this a little personally right now, because I'm sure people say the same stuff about things that I do. But
why are you saying that I'm siding with Brock? I wasn't siding with Brock. I kind of fall right in the middle.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, the couple that I've seen where there are leading lines and I look directly at the person's eye, those are unbelievable shots. And if you can't do anything but take your eye off of the interviewee, that's the whole point of having an interviewee, right? For them to help you explain the story or carry on the story.
Listen, I was a part of one of the worst live broadcast changes in recent memory. I was the first person to direct Side Sky for game. And it was not good. So I get it.
I have no idea what you're talking about right now.
Last season or two seasons ago, I forget what it was, when NBC started using a Side Sky cam for game angle.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, there were a lot of negative reviews about it, but I directed the first one, Notre Dame spring game for NBCSN. And
did the ball hit the wire?
No. So you had two Sky cams. One went along like the basically above the cart cam, essentially, right on that sideline. And then you had a normal Sky cam that went behind. I still think it could have worked. But yeah, so I get it. I'm all about pushing the boundaries and trying new things and finding what works. Also, again, it's just my personal opinion. You can disagree with it. I can be wrong. It's personal opinion.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's not, I don't think it's the opinion that I necessarily disagree with. It's more just the process at arriving at it that maybe I struggle. I don't know. I just don't like to like assume and guess what creatives are doing as they make their decisions. Like, sure. I don't want to assume that like someone saw it once and thought it was cool and was like, let's make it our look. And like, that's all the thought that went into it. Like I know people at ESPN and I trust that there was, you know, at least a good deal of discussion and thought that when that wasn't just like an off the cuff decision for one of their signature shows on the entire network.
I'm sure it was, but I'm telling you how it felt to me. Right? Sure. Like that's how it feels to me is I feel like there wasn't much intention behind it, but that doesn't mean there wasn't. Right?
No, I hear you.
I'm just letting you know how it feels to me. I would never think that ESPN would make a haphazard decision on anything, right? They're a huge company with large amounts of people, but to me, that's what it feels like, right? Sure. Like I would never accuse anybody in a major network of just making a decision just because it looks cool. But to me, that's how it feels.
No, that would never happen. Major companies do not make wildly crazy decisions just on trying to jump on a trend or look cool.
Yeah. So speaking of looking, let's talk a little bit about color, because it's funny. One of the pieces that I ended up breaking down for my group maybe a year and a half ago now, I think it was for the Contenders by a local agency here in Boston. And the thing that stood out to me about it was the direct use of blue and orange to signify cold and warm, and how you can use that color to really help hit home on the story, to be able to deliver on, you know, make people feel something that you're intending it with. You can do it with how you shoot, like we were just talking about. You can do it with color. You can do it with lighting. And really I should combine lighting and, shooting, because at the end of the day, all you're doing is really capturing light anyway. Right. So one of the things, that I've really started to get into a little bit is color theory. And that's through the motion graphics, is trying to understand, and the design is understanding what color means, and having a blue tone can make it a little bit more contrasty and dramatic, or it can make it feel a little bit more cold. Having something that's red or orange, which, by the way, I just figured this out not that long ago. The reason there's a blue screen and a green screen is because our skin color is orange, and that's on the opposite side of the color wheel from our orange skin tone. So it helps you separate. So welcome to the party, me.
Hey, bud. Good to have you.
But yeah, just being able to use the colors and understanding that color wheel, I think is really important as well. And we can get into hexadecimal if you want. That'd be one I'd nerd out, but I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, I mean, as we're just talking just generally about branding, you know, I just think it's got to be a collaborative thing throughout your whole department and throughout your whole company. You know, I think that knowing what your company and, like, you know, I talk about the journey specifically there when I was talking about branding, but I think it, you know, you got to know what the whole company's brand is too. I mean, for the Celtics, you're going to go with the Celtic green and the white and the black as your colors, and you have certain fonts and things like that within your font families that get used across anything that goes out external, not just video, not just graphics, but, you know, print or, you know, web or anything like that that gets made. So it's got to go bigger than, you know, just your department. When you think about branding, you got to think about the whole company, and it really has to be a collaborative process, I think, is one thing I would really stress. Is just, you know, I don't want to take away too much from what you were saying about color theory. I think, you know, maybe I'm going too far off topic, but I just think that, you know, when you talk about those kind of things, like, it's stuff that you've got to make sure fits within not just your like show brand or your feature brand. It's got to be big picture brand too. And the collaboration, you know, across departments is a really important part of that.
Yeah, you're spot on. It's fits in with the tone that you're trying to set or the story arc that you're trying to showcase on social or through your content too, right? We've received quite a few questions and we didn't get a chance to touch on all of them, but I think, you know, we'll
save them for another Q&A episode.
Yeah, we'll keep them and revisit. At the end of the day, you have to be the one that leads your career, and hopefully we're providing some value to you here along the way. So please hit us up with any additional questions, and thanks for tuning in on this episode.
Appreciate y'all.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives there. The quickest way to get us to stop this podcast is to not tell anyone about it. So leave us your 5-star rating and don't forget to subscribe so you're the first person to catch each new episode. And remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.